I'm hearing in the background here a little voice of a friend of mine's, a very important voice, who really laid into me the other day. Said, Megha, you cannot work on housing. You have to work on homing. Why do we even have the word house? We're never going to get to yes unless we talk about homes. Houses are just boxes. Homes are humans and hearts. And it really, we do need to find new words. Like, words matter. So it's yes to homes for everyone and yes to homing.
Hello, my name is Clay Boykin, and I am in search of the new compassionate male. I believe in the midst of these incredible times of change, a new compassionate male is emerging as the new archetype. And this podcast is intended to give voice to both men and women on the overarching topic of compassion consciousness in men.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and I am the producer of In Search of the New Compassionate Male. And I am here with the host and the founder, Clay Boykin. Clay, take it over and introduce our guest today.
Thanks, Dennis. We've got a great afternoon. Megha Sethi is with us. She is a senior level executive with a fascinating background in architecture and business strategy. And she's going to tell us about some exciting work that she's doing to help everyone have housing. Welcome, Megha.
Thank you so much, Clay and Dennis. Really thrilled to be here.
Megha, this is such a time. Have you looked historically at the time that we're living? There has never been a time when we've been seeing around the world where people have been going from $1 a day to $2 a day to $4 a day. Smartphones are getting everywhere where we're getting an opportunity. The opportunities and the disparities are both here at the same time. And then Megha Sethi arrives on the planet to be able to do something. So this is your opportunity. Tell us some of the things that you're doing in the world of housing so we have a home over our heads so that we can contribute.
You hit on some of the, in my view, most frustrating dynamics that I see in today, which is we do have so much opportunity ahead of us. We also have problems that are as big as ever. Housing is just one of those, and others, climate change. It'd be nice to have a planet to call home for the next few generations, and even that seems to be up in the air.
Yes.
But access to opportunity is something that is really near and dear to my heart because of my family's personal history. My dad was an immigrant to the United States. He came here with $4. My mom was the first in her family to go to college. And I saw the opportunities that they had. And they purchased a home. They sent three kids, my brother and sister and I, through great schools. They ran a successful business. And those same type of opportunities today are really hard, much harder than it was, 30 or 40 years ago in their time. And without those opportunities, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have the opportunities that I have today. So something that's deeply personal to me. And the role of housing in that access to opportunity is a complicated topic that's not talked about as much because it's so wonky. But at the end of the day, if you look at how, at least in the United States, families accrue wealth from one generation to the next. For better or for worse, home ownership is one of the key ways that families have been able to accrue wealth. And there's a great book. I teach a class at Cal Poly University. I'm teaching again this fall. I'm really excited on housing planning. And we do a historical deep dive in how did we get into the current housing crisis. Just in context, each year we're underproducing about 1.5 million new homes in the United States. So we have a deficit to make up for, in addition to all those who, ahead, the future demand as well, gap. And one of the key parts in the first part of my class is really going deep into how did we end up here and who's able to access housing and who's not, and how does that go back through history. And it's a sad statement. If you go back to the, you know, post-World War II, we had a great housing boom and built a lot of housing because of government support and to house veterans coming back from World War II. And over time, it became unequally available to families that were not white. Families of color could not equally access those homes. And there's a book called The Color of Law, which I highly encourage everyone to read to give
the redlining, you know?
Exactly. To give us a compassionate understanding of how we got here and how the housing laws themselves have perpetuated the inequity. And if you just think about a house in one area that might have sold for $5,000, you could buy it for $5,000 in 1952. It's actually a true story of a house that my family and I lived in. And that same house, you know, today could sell, if it's in Silicon Valley, for upwards of $2.5 million. So if the same family were to own that home, look at the amount of wealth that translates down from one generation to the next. So if you're in a, if you're from a family of color and didn't have access to that $5,000 home, not because you couldn't afford it. If you look at income parity in the middle of the 1950s, the income disparity wasn't actually as great. So if you looked across races, it wasn't as unequal in terms of income. You could, many different household types of different racial backgrounds could afford more housing back in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to today, that is not the case. And then layer on top of that, the next generation that the $5,000 home would pass on to today has hundreds of thousands of dollars, even millions of wealth that they've accrued to pay for college, to pay for a new house. And that leaves others who didn't have access, families of color that did not have access to that same opportunity back in the 1950s out, because it's really hard to accrue that much wealth otherwise. So the role of housing in equal opportunity is deep. It's rooted in the redlining policies you talked about. It's rooted in federal financing policies. Often you could build a single family subdivision in the middle of the century, 1900s, and accept government funding only if you were willing to sell it, restrict sales to white households only.
Yes.
So it's embedded in public policy. And even one home that my husband and my sons and I lived in, we purchased in San Luis Obispo. The deed said it's no longer legally valid, but the deed did say that the home was restricted to only all white households. So I'm half white. I'm half Indian. My dad's from India. Would not have qualified. But the amount of time and effort it would go to remove the language from the deed and update it is so cumbersome that the language still exists in the deeds today. It just says unenforceable.
Wow.
Yeah.
Menka, when you dig into this sense of home and what this means, an opportunity to be able to have a place to both lay our heads and to be able to restore and to be able, how did that tap into you as the place? Because of all the challenges that there are in this world, you had to choose something to do. There is an analysis paralysis that we all get when we think of, oh, well, there is so much I could possibly choose. What narrowed you into this?
I have to say that housing found me. If you believe that all is one and in synchronicity, I kind of didn't have a choice. I was an architect and I practiced just long enough to get licensed, which is tough in architecture. There's 9 exams. You have to go through lots of education and there's an internship, and I was designing hospitals. And I went to business school to get a finance, language understanding so that I could go become the developer. So do more than the design, but the financing, the approvals, the construction, management of the assets themselves. And when I was graduating from business school, one of my executive advisors, one of the few women leaders in the field at that time in real estate investment, said, "Menka, don't go into housing. You'll be pigeonholed." And sure enough, the job offers that came in, the most interesting ones were in housing. And I couldn't say no. And so for the better part of 20 years, developed housing for at affordable levels, subsidized the middle income levels, market rate housing, New York, San Francisco, in the coastal zone. And I've financed it. And I think the cherry on top of the sundae, when I worked at Facebook, I led their $1 billion investments in affordable housing. And at that point, it just hit me. I'm like, okay, housing is here to stay. I'm officially a housing person. It's in my heart. And it's a great space to be in. We definitely need more leaders. This is why I teach the university level, is there's structures we have to undo. And this was, you know, the discussion I was hoping to have with you all as well. There are, you know, deeply embedded structures in the housing space across construction, policy, approvals that really do prevent us from building enough homes so that we can balance supply demand and make access equal. And it's a very simple solution. We just have to say yes. At city councils and in our neighborhoods, when a housing project comes up, we just have to say yes to open our hearts. And then we can do this. It's not insurmountable.
Say yes to what?
Say yes so give to us homes for everyone.
Exactly. And to be able to say, all right, so what we want to do to be able to look at this entire landscape, because one of the things that we do in search of the new compassionate male is to understand that we are not in this alone. That the idea of the cowboy, the when I was growing up as Clay's older brother, I'm at 73. We had the image of the Lone Ranger, the cowboy, the I'm going to do it myself. You know, I don't need anybody, and you got to be out there and do. And that is just in this amazingly complex, in this amazingly interconnected world, everything. You turn one little gear over here, everything else turns. So what? How do you look at this so that when we do approach a city council meeting, we do approach an opportunity for housing, we get an opportunity to open that conversation?
It's a conversation that really needs to be centered around compassion and recognizing that when you're in a city council chamber or any position of power of approving a project such as more housing, you're affecting the lives of a family that may not otherwise have a home. And it may be directly, you might be approving a housing, and it's not you, it's we, because it's the populace, right? Like, we're a democracy. We are approving housing, perhaps directly for individuals who currently are unhoused, could be, you know, shelter housing. It could also be housing for essential workers. And it, right now, some of the statistics are, very scary. The number of households at the, you know, middle income stratas that make too much money to afford affordable housing, subsidized housing, and they make far too little to afford market rate housing, especially in the highest cost areas where average home, median home prices are in the millions of dollars. Those households are often one paycheck away from being homeless. So when we approve housing for that moderate strata, we're perhaps preventing a household from losing their current home, because it is a numbers demand.
Help me understand the income level. Are these high school educated people with jobs, college level people with jobs that fall in between?
It cuts across, you talked about education levels. It cuts across education levels, I think, more than we'd like to admit, which it's, and the worse the crisis gets, the more people you would, with college degrees, people who you would normally imagine are fully taking advantage of the American dream, they own a house and can accrue wealth, like we spoke of earlier, are being forced out. It's just the fewer homes we have, the fewer people who have access to them, and those at the higher end of the income spectrum can pay more, and they get bid up, and the higher income households get
so that means then that perhaps a college fresh out in the engineering world in Silicon Valley might not be able to afford to live there.
It's exactly what's happening. The younger individuals, entry-level and high-earning professions, can no longer afford to own a home. And it's a real problem. We see overcrowding as a result. Young people living at home with parents longer, households doubling up to be able to afford housing. And those stories, this is why housing, the narrative is really hard to keep track of or even to speak well to, because it's interrelated with so many different issues. So for example, when we saw numbers coming out of, oh, high density housing is bad because there are higher rates of COVID. It wasn't actually the density of the housing. It was the density, the number of families within a single home. And the reason there's overcrowding and there's many reasons. So you have to really parse out what is the root cause of the specific problem we're talking about. To Dennis, your original question, we have to recognize that when we say no to homes, that we're effectively saying our would-be neighbors don't get to have a home. Exactly. At the end of the day, that's exactly what we're saying.
And what does it cost our society, Menka, when we lose? This is an opportunity cost, because this is our talent. This is our talent pool. These are the people that can both contribute and to be. I mean, it is a short-sighted use of our, it would be like taking dollar bills and burning them for warmth. We're not using these wonderful tools, because once a person has a stable, a place to be able to do, then they can begin contribute. One of the things Clay and I have seen as we have talked to people around the world is that people are not, contrary to bless Jeff Bezos's heart, and I pay him every day when I go ahead and I put my order into Amazon, but people are not basically lazy. They are purpose driven. They want to contribute. They want, and if we can give them the opportunity to be able to have a stable place to live, they're going to contribute and give back much greater than the investment that's going to be.
Those are all great points. And there are, and fundamentally, yes, you're exactly right. And the argument that it's a, you know, economic, there's opportunity costs. It's a very rational argument to make in favor of we need more housing. And when we say no to more homes, I do think we're running up against not a rational argument. We're running up against basic human emotion and fear. And it's interesting. There were, you know, the governor recall election just happened in California, and there were a series of polls done about important issues, and some of them that came out are really interesting because cutting across political lines and different demographic stratas, people care about housing affordability. And then when you start to poll favoring on specific proposals, you never get to yes. And my takeaway is, and I have no scientific evidence, I haven't done polls, but it's a human emotion. It's the intuition. So this is where rationale alone is not going to solve housing. We have to reach people's hearts. We have to use intuition, because we run up against, I'm fearful of more people in my neighborhood. I don't want more homes because there's going to be more congestion. It's going to be harder for me to park. That means we have to build higher. I'm not going to get as much light. What if the people are noisy? Don't want it to ruin my quality of life. So those are understandable human fears. They are emotions. Right. So to get to yes on more homes for all, we have to take an emotion-based and intuition approach to get to yes.
That's beautiful.
My personal belief. Love to be proven wrong.
You know,
maybe easier.
You know, Dennis and Menka, I live in Austin, and, you know, we're seeing, you know, east of I-35 turning over, gentrification, I guess it is.
This was our in Austin. I live in north of Austin, in the little exurb at the north of Austin. This was the traditionally Latino community. This was our barrio, where here in East Austin. Just to give people who don't know Austin a little reference. Go ahead, Clay.
Yeah, and I've seen it over the past 10 years, where oh my gosh, the best deals are across on the other side of 35. And once it started happening, it's beginning to snowball. Where do the people go who have been pushed out there?
Exactly. And our question, and Minka, can we look at it historically? How long have we been as a society, as a human society, tethered to a single family home as a concept? This wasn't always the way humans lived. This idea of an individual family home and not having, you know, and having individual was not always that way. This is something that is only recent, within the last couple of hundred years, that this began to be. Is that right? Isn't that right?
It's hard to really pin down. It's a great question. I was noodling on this the other day, because we go way back, like 5,000 years plus back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point we start out as nomadic society.
Sure.
And the idea of a permanent home that was in one place didn't exist. And at some point, you know, as populations grew, we had to put in place different ordering structures, and the built environment and permanence of that built environment, I think, came along with that. And when we started to, you know, tame nature, so to speak, and grow our own food and get more sophisticated agricultural practices, mm-hmm. this idea of a farm starts to develop, which is somewhat permanent. And that's, I would guess, the one of the precursors of a single family setting. And then the lots over time, as populations grew and agriculture for each family became less and less, and we gravitated towards cities and then the country. And now we have city, country, and all this in between, and the in between is mm-hmm. taking over, and it's not so great in many cases for climate change. That it's I don't know exactly where it came about. One piece that is interesting to me of history, and again, this is outlined so beautifully in the Color of Law book. In the 1950s, when World War II ended and the U.S. government really pushed a housing agenda, there was a housing shortage for veterans coming back from the war, and there was a really quick push. And there was also actually end of the war, there wasn't enough worker housing in the new locations where, you know, ship factories popped up. So there was a really fast push to build housing quickly for lots of households. That housing was multifamily housing. And after the war, at some point, it became single family homes with a new loan type that came from the federal government that really helped developers build suburbia. And it's that housing typology, the single family home and maybe a 5,000 to 8,000 square foot lot with a white picket fence, that became the American dream.
And that just really, and that meshed into our consciousness, right?
That meshed into our consciousness. And those are the same developments that, if they accepted the government funding, which most of them did, or many of them did, could only sell the homes to white households. So that, you know, onset of the American dream and racial inequity, unequal access to housing really started. It's fascinating.
Where Minka, where does the renter fit into this scheme? Because like Clay is a homeowner, we are home renters. This home that I have, that Melissa and I have, it has three bedrooms, it has air conditioning, and it's wonderful, and we pay a rental. We are not accruing anything, but it allows me to do other things that can accrue wealth in other ways than having to do. But isn't the rental market a large part of this solution of where we're going to have to go?
Yes. And legally speaking, a lease agreement is a type of ownership.
Yes.
Just as is, you know, having deed to a house. So they are both forms of ownership. The taxation structures in the U.S. make them unequal, though, because you get tax incentives to own a home. At some point, there was a social policy decision that said home ownership is a beneficial outcome. So we're going to put subsidies. So the mortgage interest deduction, if you have a loan on a home, you can deduct part of the interest. Mm-hmm. And then the capital gains deduction when you sell a home, up to, you know, $250,000 of equity gain for an individual is tax-free, and up to $500,000 for a couple is tax-free. So if you're a renter, you're disadvantaged from a taxation perspective, but you're exactly on point where the way you're thinking about it, Dennis, which I love, is the down payment is effectively an investment in that home if you look at it from a straight financial perspective. And you might be able to earn a higher return if you were to take the down payment and not buy a home, but to put it, if you have, you know, access to really high earning investment opportunities, mm-hmm. you might do better renting and putting the down payment elsewhere. So, and there's lots of different spreadsheet analyses you can do around that. But both renting and owning are part of the solution. They are not at this point in time equally from a financial perspective, though, because of the taxation laws.
But we have to get people into places that are safe, mm-hmm. that are affordable, and we have to work on it from. So do you take a when you think about working on this, do you take a certain portion of it and say, I'm going to devote my energy into a certain part of it? Low income, middle income, other. How do you think about it in the apportionment of your energy?
I focus primarily, so in housing, there's over the past few years, there have been different frameworks for how you describe solutions to housing. One of them is the three P's. You can protect those who are currently housed, and protect the units that currently house those people, especially if they're affordable units or mm-hmm. naturally lower priced units. And you can preserve the existing housing stock. Again, that's the preservation of the existing affordable, naturally occurring affordable housing stock. And then the third P is producing more housing across the income spectrum for everyone. And it's the production pillar that is really my passion point where I lean in, because that is where we have to reach our hearts. We have to reach, recognize that we are not in this alone. We can't be the lone wolf, the cowboy, as you described, and actually think we're going to have a thriving society. We're actually all in this together, and my action impacts your action as a human. And that's the viewpoint we have to get to yes. Because we have to overcome our fears of traffic, congestion, of noise, of density to say yes.
But isn't it the developer that's got to say yes to building something that he's not going to make as much money off of? If I've got a piece of land and I have the opportunity to build a 7,000 square foot mansion on it, or put low cost housing on it, it's kind of an academic thing if I'm looking for the dollar.
My takeaway, the heart of your question, if you take it to the end game, is should housing be a for-profit industry? Should healthcare be a for-profit industry? And that's where we really have to, at the most extreme level, have to start thinking about it, because the policy framework sets up what will be built on a site. So is it possible to build a 7,000 square foot lot, single family housing typology? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, is it possible to build 4 units on that 7,000 square foot lot? Like, what is allowed? And then you do all the pencil push all the numbers to figure out what goes there best from a profit perspective, regardless of what the market need is. There is a disconnect, to your point. We do have a large public subsidy framework, tax credits, and innovative financing techniques to incentivize nonprofit organizations to build affordable housing. We have policy frameworks that require market rate housing developers to build a portion of the units as affordable, with the thought that mixed income communities are healthier than communities where it's largely affluent people in one part and lesser affluent households siphoned off in one corner. That seems less healthy. So that it really is the policy construct combined with tax policy that I think determines the outcome of the housing. May not be the right way to approach it, but that is what we have right now.
Well, that's what we, and so in, when you take a bite of this, are you doing this through a teaching perspective, through your students? Are you doing this through an advocacy and policy level? Are you doing it through talking to builders and working through what are some of your activities that you're putting your energy into right now, Menka?
Yes. Yes, because you have to do a little bit of everything. One, so I am teaching for sure. I'm continuing, I continue to advocate for what are the right policies. And depending on, it's a confluence of where my work life is at and where my personal life is at and the overlap between the two. I'm on the board of a nonprofit affordable housing developer. So that's building affordable housing directly. I'm very fascinated with the idea, and there's some great press in the New York Times last week about the move to build homes more quickly and cheaply in factory settings. And there was a run through of various different companies that have started that. While I was at Facebook, I helped the seed investment in one of those companies. So I'm committed to new technologies and doing whatever I can, either as an investor or an advisor, to get some of those off the ground to complement the policy advocacy. And then the teaching part is really setting up the future leaders in the housing space. But I believe the part that we need the most work as really the emotion, the human psyche piece behind it. And I think that's been left behind. Wow. There's been so many data studies on how are we going to change the narrative around housing, and they're really important. And the findings are really important, and they provide a lot of data, such as the opportunity costs that you spoke about, Dennis. There's very little literature out there on the emotion narrative, the intuition narrative. And I don't think we're going to get to yes until we crack that.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that I want to know. All right. So as you have two sons, right?
I have two beautiful sons who are now living in the country. We left Silicon Valley proper for during COVID to shelter in place. It's less populated here. And raising children in a less dense country setting where the biophilia is really at play. They have access to nature and all different parts, is a really healthy living experience. That makes me think a lot about what is a healthy living experience mean for a child, and what is the housing type? Ideally we should have housing home types in any urban, suburban, or rural setting that is healthy, but we haven't quite gotten there yet. So there's a lot of work to be done. And again, it goes back to the psychology of homes. So that's the part that I think needs the most work.
What do you see in your son's eyes when you talk with them about and opening up their minds and hearts? Because we were talking about how when Clay and I were growing up, we had very strong stereotypes of what a man was, and that wasn't always what we actually were, but we had these stereotypes that we were going to do it. So now your sons are growing up in a much more diverse as far as the media is concerned, we're starting to see opportunities. So as you're raising these young men and opening up them up to their emotions and their intuition and their compassion and that, tell us what that's like.
It's pure joy to watch through their eyes. My sons are age 9 and 10, going on 11. And it's, we've traveled quite a bit with them. My youngest son was born and we brought him home to, it was a duplex we lived in. And, my father now lives in an apartment. It's a 5-story building. My boys right now, we're in a single family home, and I don't think they have a view the way I've seen it. They delight in the difference of the types. They think going to grandpa's house is like going to a hotel. An apartment to them is like a hotel, and it's fabulous. They love it. They just think it's like Disneyland. And a single family home to them, in their mind, the most beautiful part about a single family home is one that has staircases. And I have no idea where that came from. But so they have these images that I don't know where they come from, what they view as good or bad. I don't see a good or a bad. I just see delight in kind of random association.
Isn't that wonderful? What an opportunity, because I love the optimism that can be, that we can look out at the world and say, there are more opportunities for us to make a difference than we possibly can imagine. So let's step into it. Let's see where we can grow. That's what's so exciting to me about it. And as we talk to people, Clay, you've talked to people around the world. Clay was in Kenya. Clay, you had this experience in Kenya with these warriors that you went over and you were being part of a class with, and you saw it there.
Absolutely. You know, it's a totally different situation, but so many of the people that I worked with, they were HIV/AIDS orphans and had no place. They were living on the street. And thank goodness, a woman, a fascinating woman that Dennis and I know, named Karambu Ringera, Dr. Karambu Ringera, started working now 12 years ago to develop a children's home for just those children, and took this piece of land that was nothing and has turned it into a children's home. And there has been several thousand.
And all. Oh.
They go to local schools, but they come home. They have a place to come home, and several thousand children have been through there, and they come back to help. You know, it's a whole...
It's a part of a community. This sense of community, Menka, that you're talking about, do you have a sense from your history in India of the sense of community that was there, the namaste, the sense that we're all one and that we're all part of this whole, and bringing that part into the United States, into the what the American dream is, and recreating this American dream, because that's one of my passions, is being able to redefine what does it mean, what is enough, and what is the American dream? How can we recreate it into a place that is more inclusive and diverse and nurturing for all?
I love that, the sense of community. I have to say, my family just went through a really transformative experience where we lived in a classic, you know, 1950s white picket fence, single family area in Silicon Valley. And if you looked at it aesthetically, it is the American dream. It should have the community. But there's the stress in place is palatable, that the housing is expensive, the commutes are terrible, because the transportation infrastructure doesn't match, you know, housing and job locations well, and the housing types aren't at the, you know, at the best densities to match where the jobs are, and it's all tied together. And so it's palpable and it's stress, and I think it leads to, I don't know, a different type of community. And I could see the anxiety in my children. So we actually this summer, we moved full time to the country, and it's far less populated. And the schools, from a numbers perspective, are, you know, not as highly rated, but the sense of community is second to none. In fact, at the school board meeting, they were talking not about test scores. They were talking about, well, the kids had gained weight over summer because of COVID, because they were kept inside. And how can we address this at the school? Because that's really affecting their learning outcomes. And the teacher, my older son's teacher's emails are signed, "You can't educate a child if you don't first take care of their heart." And there was one day we had a family emergency. Neither my husband nor I could take my sons to school. We do have, there are real challenges. There's no bus because we can't, there's local labor shortage because housing is too expensive. So there's no bus driver. So for the time being, we have to drive the boys to school, which we love. It's favorite part of my day, but we couldn't be there to do it. And people were, we had too many people saying yes to drive them to school. They all wanted to drive them to school. So it takes a village. So I do think the sense of community is here. I think it's undoing some of the stress structures that are causing us, you know, all the traps of binary thinking, black and white thinking, housing's too expensive, we have to work too much to afford a home. Like the basic needs it's fracturing. It's being met less and less, the basic needs. When we can solve that, I think we can restore the sense of community because we're all more open and able emotionally.
It makes perfect sense. And I love your focus on the dangers of binary thinking, because I try to work with my sense of purpose as a rheostat rather than as a light switch. If I can just move incrementally along toward the one, instead of the one and zero being the two poles I go to, I'm somewhere along the continuum. And if we can move it along that continuum toward the one, now I can provide incremental solutions that can move ourselves in that direction, because our minds, our media culture is built for that binary thinking, good and bad, left and right, instead of the incrementalism.
The richness is definitely the in between, the unknown. It's amazing if you go in without expectations, the outcomes. That's definitely what I've seen through my son's eyes and our new adventure.
As we're
having this conversation, I'm hearing in the background here a little voice of a friend of mine, who's a very important voice, who really laid into me the other day, said, "Menka, you cannot work on housing. You have to work on homing. Why do we even have the word house? We're never going to get to yes unless we talk about homes. Houses are just boxes. Homes are humans and hearts." And it's so right. And I'm realizing throughout this conversation, I've been using the word housing. And it really, we do need to find new words. Like, words matter. So it's yes to homes for everyone and yes to homing. Housing is probably not helping us in the inch the needle, as you were saying, as much as homes does.
I love that because when I was growing up, there was a strong phrase, home is where the heart is.
Yes.
So it does connect us at that heart level. So if we can see what home is and how we can really work on that definition and work on that definition of what is home. And how can we feel it, taste it, experience it in new ways?
That really hits home. I mean,
love it.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't say that really hits house. It really hits home because it touched me in the heart. Yeah,
yeah.
Housing. It's an asset. It's literally an asset class, a real estate asset class, and it's an investment. And again, it goes back to the question of where does housing industry, it's seen as a finance asset class. It's not seen as people's lives. So homing maybe shifts that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that. I love it. And as we get an opportunity to be able to see what home is, then we can then it automatically opens up my heart. It opens my mind to possible solutions about there is no way with the place where we live has three bedrooms and it has two baths and it has running potable water. I have a machine that washes clothes. It also dries clothes. All I have to do is put materials in and it washes and then move it over and air dries it. I mean, I live like an emperor. Now I can quantitatively have extra bedrooms or extra time, but I can't qualitatively have more blessings than I have right now. It's all from now on, it's my mindset. It's how am I going to be able to appreciate all the blessings of everything? Because all of my basic needs are so joyously and graciously taken care of.
This is a great reminder. What's present for me as you were describing, especially the machine that washes clothes, it's amazing, is what the idea of flexibility and what a home means to each of us. So when we start talking about what does a home mean for each of us, sometimes it's not even about, and many times it's not about the building. It's about the people and the light and the sounds. But we have these things called building codes for a reason, and a house is subject to building codes. There's the flexibility of what the house structure is determined by codes, planning, building, fire, earthquake, you name it. And there is one school of thought that the pragmatic guidelines that a house fits in limits the flexibility. Yes, we need some basic standards. But the idea of what a home is, there's far more flexibility in the definition of a home compared to definition of a house. And the gap between those definitions might be a bit much. And we might be able to provide more homes for everyone if we could reduce that gap and increase flexibility so that we can get to a point where everyone has a home.
I mean, we've seen, I mean, this, I have a feeling just like when John Kennedy in 1960 said that we're going to be to the moon or 1961 said that to be to the moon by the end of the decade. There were so many unintended consequences that came from the research because we did not have the technology to do that. My hope is that what happened in COVID during this time, from our opportunities, just like we're having this wonderful conversation with you today, is that it's going to open our minds and our hearts to new ways of living, new ways of working, new ways of communicating, new solutions that we would not have thought of had we not been forced to go through this experience.
That is a beautiful hope. I spent a lot of time thinking about where do we land post COVID and what is normal work, life balance, where we live, how we live, schooling, education.
Yes.
I think we have a huge opportunity that we can embrace, to your point.
This last Sunday, I lost my virtual reality virginity. So this is... And
here we go.
I had never had that. I'd never had it happen before. But we went to an art exhibit, and it was a different art exhibit. And one of them was I put on the virtual reality glasses and was able to go on a canoe that went through the small boat, and a dog jumped on the front of it and looked back at me, and it was and even though, and this was on this was powered by a smartphone, not just, I mean, this is how quickly this is happening. So the different ways of us participating within a community and participating in a way are going to be coming into these ways of working, these ways of relating. So it's really keeping our minds and our hearts open into ways. And I really love your focus on home and bringing that in alignment with housing and having those two things come together.
You know, when you just said that, Dennis, it reminded me of a dear friend who left Austin and moved to another state. And I said, how can you leave your home here and just uproot and go to another place? And he said, I'm not leaving my home. I'm leaving the house. My home. My home is where my wife and I are at the present moment, wherever that may be.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That is just beautiful. Oh, Menka, thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to have a few minutes with you. And to what is there anything that we've not talked about that is on your mind and heart today?
No, thank you. I'm so grateful for your time and your interest and your openness and your focus on compassion. I do really believe that compassion is how we are going to find homes for everyone, create homes for everyone. So thank you.
I do too. It is a pleasure. Clay, your thoughts?
This is a whole world opening up for me. Again, house to home, even that just basic thought. And I'm just so grateful that you're able to join us and to be here and to share your wisdom.
I agree. I agree, Menka. One of the things that I love about being on this series with Clay, who founded this, is that the goal is to change me. The goal is for me to learn and me to grow. And if as long as I understand that I go local to global, instead of trying to fix out there, I can work on me, and then I'm going to be a stronger person to step out into this. And you've helped me so much in opening my heart to new ways, new perspectives, new ways of looking at what we're going to be doing. And I'm looking forward to having more conversations with you in the future. And thank you for giving us an opportunity to spend some time with you today.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. My heart is melting. Immense gratitude.
Thank you, Menka Sethith, and thank you, Clay Boykin, for giving us a chance to be on In Search of the New Compassionate Male, and for everyone who got a chance to hear our hearts open and to be here on this experience. Thank you, and we'll see you next time. And scene.
Great. Thank you. That was so fun. Thank you for letting me get in the homing, not housing. This friend of mine.
I love that.
Oh, it is just lovely. Menka, I will reach out to you myself. I would love to have a conversation with you on where have I'll reach out to you. And Clay, my love to you, my precious Clay. And
poof, there he goes. He does that.
And Clay, I'm realizing I didn't send you my housing write-up that you were going to on the Compassionate City. So I need to do that. I am behind. I'm recognizing that. It will happen.
Great. And is that something that's been published?
No.
Write-up?
This is, I have never actually taken, it's a good exercise. You are the second person to ask. So I really need to do it. It is the world telling me I need to do this, which is to write a short narrative in a couple sentences and no more that describes both my personal and my professional work in this space across the last two decades. So that's what I'm trying to do. I need to do that.
Well, so while you're doing that, which will take just a few minutes, I'm just sure. Minutes. You know, what was it? Mark Twain once said, if I had more time, this would have been a shorter letter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, but it will happen. It's actually a very important exercise to me personally too. So I'm grateful you.
Yeah. Well, and my action is I'll edit. And like I said before, I'll send you a private link and so that you can preview it.
Perfect. Thank you. I didn't say, we didn't even get close to any of the topics we touched. So
okay. But nonetheless, I want you to preview it before it goes out.
Okay.
And there were two or three, what I customarily do is I'll grab something from it in the middle. And I'll put it as a teaser at the front. Okay. And there's several places where I was going, that's it. No, this is it. No, this one's it.
Oh, no. Well, I can't wait. But
yeah. The other thing, too, is once it's published, then my intention is to connect you and Gar Jameson.
Okay.
In Las Vegas. So that's the order of things.
Perfect.
Yeah. And he will watch this. He'll take it to heart. You and he, it'll be a wonderful conversation. You'll love it.
I can hardly wait. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was so fun. Made my day. I'm grateful. Great.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you or someone you know has something to share about men and compassion, write me directly at clay@clayboykin.com or visit the website newcompassionatemail.com. Thank you.